It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Since 2002, Mohamedou Salahi has been imprisoned at the detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, even though the United States has never charged him with a crime. A federal judge ordered his release in March of 2010, but he remains in prison. Salahi has kept a diary that has been published. It's called Guantanamo Diary. It was edited by my guest, Larry Seams, who is appearing tonight as part of a City of Asylum presentation. He joins us now in studio to discuss the process he went through in editing this diary. Larry Seams, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks so much for having me.
And if you want to join our conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Let's start by finding out a little bit about who Mohamedou Salahi is and how you crossed paths with him.
Mohamedou is a Mauritanian. He's from Nouakchott, Mauritania. He was disappeared, essentially, by the United States, not in Afghanistan, not in Pakistan.
You use that as a verb. He was disappeared.
He was disappeared in the very conventional human rights sense of, you know, a man who was detained and moved into a secret prison and nobody knew where he was. He was a remarkably talented young man. He was the ninth of 12 children of a camel trader in Mauritania, and was a tremendous student and won a scholarship to study engineering in Germany. And in 1989, he was the first person in his family to get on an airplane to go to Europe. Studied engineering, was there for 10 years, briefly tried to live in Canada when he couldn't get permanent residency in Germany, and then returned to Mauritania in 2000. One thing he had done when he was a student in Germany was in 1991 and 1992, he did something that many young men were doing throughout Europe, and that is he went to Afghanistan to join the Mujahideen forces that were fighting the communist-backed government in Kabul. And he trained, he had to get training, and he trained at an Al-Qaeda camp, which at the time was supported by the United States. He remembers training on mortar shells from cases that said, made in the USA. He did that a couple times. He was there for 2 months, went back and studied some more, and then went back for one of the final battles before the communist-backed government fell. And when that happened, he was out. He said, you know, the different Mujahideen factions started to shoot each other to see who was going to be president. He said, this is not what I signed up for. He went back to Germany, finished his engineering degree, and worked in Germany, then briefly in Canada, returned to Mauritania in 2000.
Okay, so up to now, we're not hearing anything that would raise any red flags, seemingly.
No, I mean, he had joined Al-Qaeda, but many, many people had,
Didn't the United States arm Osama bin Laden during when the Soviets were there?
Exactly. And so he was in Germany. He had briefly crossed paths with one of the hijacker recruiters when he was there. When he was in Montreal in Canada, he went to the same mosque as a guy named Ahmad Rassam, who was arrested in what they called the Millennium Bomb Plot. So as Colonel Morris Davis, who was the chief prosecutor of Guantanamo, has described it, you know, he was kind of like the Forrest Gump, you know, of the story, where he would just kind of show up in these places where Al-Qaeda had some active presence. But, you know, the intelligence community ultimately concluded that he wasn't actively engaged in those things. But he was
on. He was not.
He was emphatically not. But he was on the U.S. intelligence's radar. He was questioned several times even before 9/11. After 9/11, I think there was an effort to kind of round up anybody who we thought could help us understand this organization and its structures, especially in Europe. And so he got another call on November 20th, almost 14 years ago to the day, was asked by the director of state intelligence in Mauritania to come in for another round of questioning. He got in his car, drove to the police station, and this time he never came home. The U.S. had the Jordanians send a rendition flight to pick him up. He was sent to Amman, Jordan, interrogated in an intelligence prison in Amman for 9 months. The Jordanians concluded that he was not anybody of significance and were to send him home to Mauritania. Instead, the CIA sent a rendition flight, picked him up in Amman, sent him to Bagram Air Base, and then on to Guantanamo, where he's been since August of 2002.
Why is he still there, especially after a federal judge ordered him released in March of 2010?
I think that's a question that we all should be asking. I think it's a very simple question, and it's one that the United States government has never satisfactorily answered. And as you point out, in their one opportunity to really emphatically answer that question, which was in defending his incarceration in a habeas corpus proceeding, they lost. The judge said, you know, no, this does not add up. He must be released. I think, you know, personally, my view, having looked at this for quite a while, I think if you read his story, you have some clues to why he might still be there, which is just when he was in Guantanamo, he was singled out for one of the most brutal interrogations there. He was one of two prisoners who were designated for what they called special projects interrogations, which were really prolonged torture sessions that spanned a number of months. That special project, so-called, was carried out by a special projects team in deep secrecy, but according to written plans that were signed off on all the way up to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And you know, and that story has been, it was locked down for years. His manuscript, he wrote the manuscript in 2005 in which he tells the story. That manuscript, the manuscript itself was a classified secret until 2012. It was released thanks to the endless efforts of his attorneys to get it declassified. But one of the reasons that they prevailed was by that time, Freedom of Information Act litigation had produced many, many government documents that essentially told the same story, that really this incredibly well-documented, incredibly abusive interrogation.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm talking with Larry Seams, who edited the Guantanamo Diary, Mohamedou Slahi's account of his time at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. He started writing this, about 3 years into his incarceration in Guantanamo. What does he write about?
Well, it's, you know, I think that's where this becomes a, you know, really remarkable achievement and what I think will be a book that stands on the bookshelves of, you know, great prison literature from throughout history. He writes, you know, not only about what he endured and what he suffered, but ultimately about the human beings that he's sharing space with. And, you know, you think about the incredibly rigorous censorship that's been imposed around Guantanamo. To this day, no writer or journalist has ever been able to speak with a Guantanamo prisoner. I have never been able to speak with Mohamedou to this day.
How did you cross paths with him?
Well, I had been doing work with a declassified documentary record and a project with the ACLU called The Torture Report, in which I was sort of reconstructing narratives from this fragmentary record. One of those stories that came most vividly to my attention was the story of Mohamedou's interrogation and torture. And right about the time I finished that project, his attorneys had managed to get this manuscript declassified. So they contacted me and said, would I like to see it? And I said, absolutely. I know it'll be an interesting story. And I also knew from those documents that Mohamedou was a remarkable, charismatic storyteller, because we had transcripts of his appearances before review board hearings in Guantanamo in 2004 and 2005. And in those, he speaks with this kind of direct, transparent, but very human, funny, and engaging voice. And that's the voice that creates this, you know, incredible work, which I think is, you know, it's not only a story that exposes, you know, the kind of violent mistreatment of prisoners, a story which, as I say, we already knew from the documentary record, but it really, it for the first time, gives us a look of the human experience of Guantanamo, not just of the prisoners, but also of the guards and interrogators. And I think what he manages to do in this incredibly dehumanizing environment, an environment that's specifically aiming at dehumanizing him, you know, he not only maintains his own dignity and humanity, but he insists on, you know, presenting the lives of his guards and interrogators in all of their emotional and moral complexity as well.
And so you come to be involved in editing this project. And what was that like, trying to whittle this down to a book?
Well, it's an extremely strange process to be editing the work of a writer who's alive but incommunicado.
Yeah, you can't talk to him.
Yeah, it's very strange.
No letters, nothing?
None whatsoever. I wrote a letter. I have no idea if he ever received it. I did, you know, in a formal way, request one visit with him when I had done an edit of the manuscript, because I think it's the right of every writer, no matter who they are, where they are, to have final say in how their words appear in print. I was denied that, as has every writer and journalist who has sought to speak with a prisoner.
Have you gotten any kind of word as to how he feels about this book being out now?
Yes. I his attorneys visit him periodically, and I think, you know, obviously it's been a very gratifying for him that it's published, not just in the U.S., but in countries around the world, including recently in Arabic, which means he can read it. So, you know, it's been a great source helping him persevere. I will say, though, that I think, he went for 7 years where he thought that this book would never see the light of day. Then he knew that it was coming out. It came out. It got a great deal of attention. He is still there, you know, and I think in some ways that my guess is that that comes with its own kind of emotional weight, where you all this time you're thinking, if people would just hear this story, which is a very simple appeal for justice, things will change. It's out. He's still there.
I don't want to run out of time before we have a chance to hear an excerpt. You've got something that you can share with us, so I'll let you read that.
Great. This is just one of those passages where he's reflecting on the complicated relationships that develop with his captors.
And again, these are the words of Mohamedou Slahi, imprisoned at Guantanamo, as read by Larry Seams.
And yet, let's look at it from the interrogator's perspective. They were literally taught to hate us detainees. Those people are the most evil creatures on earth. Do not help the enemy. Keep in mind they are enemies. Look out, the Arabs are the worst, especially the Saudis and the Yemenis. They're hardcore. They're savages. Watch out. Don't. Redacted. Unless you secure everything. The government would hold back basic information from its interrogators for tactical reasons and then tell them the detainee you are assigned to is deeply involved in terrorism and has vital information about coming and already performed attacks. Your job is to get everything he knows. In fact, I hardly met a detainee who was involved in a crime against the United States. So you have interrogators who are prepared, schooled, trained, and pitted to meet their worst enemies. And you have detainees who typically were captured and turned over to U.S. forces without any proper judicial process. After that, they experienced heavy mistreatment and found themselves incarcerated in another hemisphere in Gitmo Bay by a country that claims to safeguard human rights all over the world, but a country that many Muslims suspect is conspiring with other evil forces to wipe the Islamic religion off the face of the earth. All in all, the environment is not likely to be a place of love and reconciliation. The hatred here is heavily watered. But believe it or not, I have seen guards crying because they had to leave their duties at Gitmo. I am your friend. I don't care what anybody says, said one guard to me before he left. I was taught bad things about you, but my judgment tells me something else. I like you very much, and I like speaking with you. You're a great person, said another. I hope you get released, said genuinely. You guys are my brothers, all of you, another whispered to me. I love you, said a corpsman once to my neighbor, a funny young guy I personally enjoyed talking to. He was shocked. What? Hear no love? I am Muslim. I just laughed about that forbidden love. But I couldn't help crying myself one day when I saw a German descended guard crying because I got hurt just a little bit. The funny thing was I hid my feelings because I didn't want them to be misinterpreted by my brethren or understood as a weakness or betrayal. At one point, I hated myself and confused the hell out of myself. I started to ask myself questions about the humane emotions I was having toward my enemies. How could you cry for someone who caused you so much pain and destroyed your life?
That's Larry Seams reading from the Guantanamo Diary by Mohamedou Slahi. And Larry Seams will be appearing at the City of Asylum tonight. Larry, thanks so much for joining us. We're out of time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Have a good Veterans Day, everyone. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.